From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Catalogued, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where Nice Game Devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark McCroy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are naming files and Unity Security Vulnerability 2025. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start. Ooh, you know, we get like lunch, dinner in between recording episodes.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like sometimes that makes me way more tired for the second episode. It's probably because I ate too many pancakes.
So that's what to expect, listener, is a very satisfied, but also lethargic. Steven.
Yep. That's what I'm contributing.
Well, it's great because you don't have a topic this week. Yeah. So you can really just hang back and.
Cool. I'm a chill. Y'all got this.
Yeah.
But first, Lydia, apparently you're leaving town.
Yeah, I'm tired for a different reason. I am doing. So back in the day when I was not a host and I got interviewed about a escape room that is both in person and a digital version of it, and the process of doing that. I was very excited that I got to work on this escape room again, and it has been a time this year.
Yeah.
But part of one of the things that the project manager on the client side asked me, just like DM over LinkedIn, was like, "Hey, would you still be interested in helping to run the escape room during the conference itself?" And I said, "Yeah." So I've had the conference itself as a line in my calendar since summer.
Okay.
And we finally got the okay from all the powers that be on both sides, and you know, the extra contract and the logistics and stuff. I'm gonna be in Chicago next weekend from Saturday to Wednesday at the Chest Conference 2025. I'm gonna get to run the escape rooms and reset them. I'm gonna get to talk to a bunch of pulmonologists and pulmonology healthcare people, which sounds like a cool time. Gonna see some friends as well. And I'm excited. I'm excited also to take a lot of photos. And it's a little special this year also because I, in an attempt to be helpful while we were waiting for patient data, I also volunteered to help make some of the props. Because I can make things in real life. I can't make things in digital space. Such is my life, right? So I've made some of the props. Maybe I could put some photos of the work in progress here.
That'd be exciting.
They are safely in Chicago now, and which is good because some of them could have leaked.
Oh.
And I'm very excited to cool. get to help out with that.
Yeah, I mean, because you have this is something that is still sort of unusual for you in terms of day-to-day work, but it's something you have some experience with.
Yes.
It's kind of a fun little like place to be for something like this,
yeah,
right?
That was part
of exciting but not as scary perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of what was so exciting when I first got asked to if I could take on this project last year was because I found that I liked design when exploring museums as a career. And I found I loved exhibit design. I really liked collections care, but I found that I was not gentle and delicate enough to do collections care all the time, every day as my job. I
like
really
turning your glove and your other glove.
Yeah. And also just the like, oh God, this is so delicate. I need to be very careful with how I move.
Yeah.
I can't do that all the time. I loved exhibit design. And so working in person and making interactive experiences and then also then learning about like, oh, here's the ways that children can irreparably destroy things. Here's the ways that people who facilities people maintain it and keep it clean because everyone is disgusting. Oh my God. Please thank your facilities people. It's gross. All of that is stuff that I could bring to the table and I hadn't had to access in a while. And it's really fun to get to do that again.
That's very cool. It sort of just maybe reminded me of videos I've seen on YouTube of people who work at the Lego Discovery Centers
mm-hmm.
and like the power wash equipment they need mm-hmm. to do to wash to clean off the displays.
Damn.
Yeah. I did an internship at the Montshire Museum of Science in Vermont, which is a fantastic museum. You should go if you can. Mm-hmm. And every morning, my routine was essentially to walk the exhibit floors and reset everything, report anything that was broken to facilities, if there was something that needed to be cleaned, let them know or do it myself, and basically just like reset the space. And it was really, it was always really nice. Like, you know, and it was a lot of little things like putting stuff back into bins, tuning a guitar because we had the Science of Music exhibit that came up that I was around for, you know, making sure that the stuffed bear is back in the bear hole, in the bear den in the early childhood exhibit, you know, stuff like that.
Very cool. So when listeners hear this episode, you'll have recently returned.
Yes.
So folks should go to the Discord, Nice Games Club's Discord, and ask Lydia how it went.
Yeah.
You can do that right now.
Mm-hmm.
Go do that.
We'll wait.
Also very relevant to my time in museums mm-hmm. is my deep, I think a little bit also my love, my history roots and my love for Chicago style footnotes is my deep love of well-labeled things.
Ah!
Oh my God.
I was like, is she going to talk about deep dish pizza or the Chicago Manual of No. Style? Which one?
I'm from the East Coast. We're not talking about deep dish pizza. Fight me. So I want to have a chance for everyone to vent a little bit because, oh my God, are there so many instances where things that are not labeled well or named well in a file structure or in Unity sucks
so much.
Tell me a little bit about ones that irk you, because I know that there we've talked before.
Well, I can talk a little bit about so I have a session like you mm-hmm. with making sure things are organized and named correctly, that there is a system and it's kept to
mm-hmm.
and that's important, especially when you're dealing with lots of random things all over the place or you're working in multiple projects, multiple disciplines, or really just trying to archive anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When I started working in games and I started using source control, it actually kind of threw me for a loop a little bit because I was used to iterating things by file name, saving multiple versions of assets, and
right.
doing that kind of manually
yeah.
in a way, and then backing everything up and having my own system for that, and realizing that code and project structures required much more consistency
yep.
and essentially like current snapshots rather mm-hmm. than like iterative components.
Mm-hmm.
That it took me a while to get used to that idea and bring my existing systems for archiving and asset management mm-hmm. to frameworks which required it to do it in a totally different and almost unseen way
yeah.
in certain instances. And there are times where I made mistakes along the way before I finally got it, I think. Mm-hmm. And for a while I was like, oh man, it's like this industry does this badly because I just didn't understand it yet.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? The key was to always remain obsessed with it, mm-hmm. so eventually learn how to do it rather than give up on it.
That's the
because I have seen yep. people do that.
Yeah,
where they just is like, this is complicated, unfamiliar. I will just proceed, blindly and just hope nothing breaks.
Well, I think that also brings up an important point where are your naming conventions and labels being seen.
Yeah,
because yeah. I come from a position where I have worked in Engine. And needed to access things in engine.
Yeah.
Not necessarily had to follow the chain of source control of where things were entered or exited, but with the knowledge that was going to be visible in some way. Mm-hmm. And file structures and shared drives outside of the project that immediately would like have relevance or importance. So it's like, we need to be able to follow the chain of documentation, the chain of asset creation, and be able to know one for one, this asset came from here and was and is this.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's very different people handling it, visible in very different ways and under scrutiny in different ways, is to kind of touch on what you said really kind of matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have had difficulty dealing with names when it's like I'm dealing with art files.
Mm.
And you know, like Mark was saying, like they're different worlds. It's like you name things differently for different purposes. And so like you'll name, this is version 2 or version
yeah.
this date or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I'm not always aware of that. So like if no one tells me that this thing is new, I won't update it in Unity. And thus, it doesn't get updated. And that could be problematic.
Yeah.
And so like I feel like I just need to be sent the correct files, which I don't think is a very efficient system. It's better if everybody just has access to Unity and just is able to implement it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not always the case.
No.
Yeah, there's a difference between like a robust system and an intuitive system.
Yeah.
And those goals, if you can get them to align, bully for you.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes they don't, and you have to balance them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
honestly, the naming, the thing I have an issue with respect to naming is how people name their variables. Mm-hmm. Because, like, I feel like I can't stand it when people, like, name their stuff, like, I or, you know, a little tiny, just one letter, and you're supposed to know.
You're not going
to
run out of characters.
Yeah. It's not algebra class.
Exactly. Yeah. It only makes sense if you're doing it in a loop, because then you know what it is, because that's, like, standard.
Yeah.
But otherwise, and even then, you know, you could just write it. You can write it as index. That's also fine.
I mean, it also, it harks very much to, like, when teachers would say, well, I equals what? I equals 15. Well, what is 15 what? 15 cookies? 15
right?
baseballs?
15 yeah.
Tax attorneys?
Exactly.
What?
Exactly. People don't label the heck. They don't even label what the variable is. And, it's all.
Well, related, here's sort of a hot tip. Maybe it's oblique to the topic, but, like, when you have multiple for loops, you tend to go, like, I then J and stuff. That's fine, especially if they're nested. But I think, especially if it gets really hairy, I like to, as soon as you need a second one, then just name them semantically.
Sure.
Like this is an index for this. This is an index for this. What are you tracking the index of?
Yeah.
And then just use that because you will quickly mix up what's I and what's J, especially if you're working with like indexed arrays, like multidimensional arrays. Like, yes, you will be like barfing a lot of characters onto your screen to make this better.
Yeah.
But it's super worth it.
Yeah, makes it clear.
If it's just a for loop in isolation, just use I. It's fine. Yeah. I'm not going to be extreme about that.
Yeah.
But I have sometimes in a complicated code base where I need to like walk myself through it. I was like, you know what? I should actually say what this is an index of.
Yeah.
Even if it's a not complicated system.
Yeah.
That's maybe more programming advice, but it really applies to naming because sometimes you can, you know, logo.png.
Yeah.
Sometimes that contextual, depending on where it is, sometimes that matters. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that is just a recipe for future confusion.
Yeah.
Right?
For me, one of the things that kept coming up in my last job was because it was a job with a lot of history and we had, objects or machines that, you know, had existed in the past, but went through a couple iterations, including ones that happened while I was working there.
Yeah.
If I was going to be, I would like stage a scene. I couldn't test in editor with a headset because my graphics card wasn't good enough. And yeah, so I would stage the scene and then someone else with a headset would like fine tune it. So that way it worked. Mm-hmm. But every time I would type in like, what was it? Like neutralizer or neutron machine or whatever, there would be three that would come up. And I could never tell which one was the most recent one.
Right.
Sure. Yeah.
And some of it is like, okay, is one of these a gray boxed one? Is one of these just the 3D asset and not the game object? What is it? And because the file structure was a nightmare and I wasn't exactly going to go in and rearrange it for everybody because that would be a recipe for disaster at that point because it's just, it's existed. It needs to, I don't know if that would mess up the code, but when it comes to like the labeling, there was no way for me to, I was relying on the search bar and there was no way for me to figure out what actually was right.
Yeah.
And if there was any iteration and multiple objects that was recent, you know, which one do I use?
Right.
Which one is the most extant version?
Yes, yes. Sometimes it's okay, but I think saving archived versions or previous versions within a project where you can get that kind of confusion is, I think, immediately a bad idea.
Mm. So what I suggest for anything that is obsoleted or archived that we keep in there, and there are reasons to keep it in there, I think that are very valid, rename them all caps archive. Are all caps right. obsolete?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Put them somewhere where they can't be confused. Or, like I said, I think you should take them out of the project as soon as you don't need them. If you need them for something else, then it is something else and should have a different name.
Sure.
I think. Which is basically what you're describing.
If you do not have the time, energy, spoons, or risk assessment to take them out of the project,
risk assessment.
Name them so obviously wrong.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, I do this in my writing too. If I'm writing something that I know is placeholder, I make it the most ugly shade of aqua highlight possible because I know that it's meant to be wrong.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. That's essentially taking something out of your system rather than making something like, oh, I don't know where this goes. Instead of struggling to find a way to make it fit, just kick it out the door for a bit, make it really obvious it's not part of the system.
Yeah.
I do something very similar with things that I definitely need to get out of a project or away, or code that is totally refactored, and the Git history is not going to quite let me find it again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but I still want to hold on to it somewhere. I just have a like a kind of a laundry pile folder mm-hmm. in all my projects called holding.
Mm. Yeah.
It's where I hold things and I don't do any, I just dump it in that folder. And if you ever go in there, it's like completely unorganized and totally messy. When a project is done, I can delete the whole thing. Mm-hmm. If I need to find something, I can take the energy to go digging.
Sure.
But there are definitely times when you want to like put a lot of energy up front to like get things right, organize things as you make them one at a time. Don't waste this time because it's going to be harder later.
Yeah.
And then there are times when you just, it's okay to just throw it in the laundry pile.
Yeah. The other thing, another one where I will like all caps right at the beginning of it, and I think maybe is a little bit more relevant to keep in the project than something that would be clearly archive or obsolete, prototype.
Sure.
Right.
Especially because you may end up finding like, oh, you're working on this thing that you thought was actually going to be the final version. It ended up being more like a phase two prototype. And then now you're working on the final version. Rename those things prototype.
Yeah.
So that way you can return to them if you need to. But you unequivocally know that this is not the thing that you should be dragging into the inspector.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Right.
So we already talked a little bit about this, you know, essentially what on the assumption you have a system. Or even if you don't have a system, basically pulling out as much obviously this is not what you should do as clearly as possible. Mm-hmm. That is something one aspect of this.
Yeah,
I want to talk a bit about where my mentality for naming things comes from. If it's okay for time, and then I also want to give an example from the current project I'm working on, the chess project, mm-hmm. because I did a bunch of VO for it that then. Went through an AI process to make my voice sound like someone else because I can't sound like, you know, three different women and a bunch of differently aged men as much as I want to try. And then it had to be handed to a developer mm-hmm. to be put in the right spot. So where it came from, I mentioned I worked in museums. My first internship out college was with Rice County Historical Society in Faribault, Minnesota. You should go there. It's really great. And they're wonderful people. And that's where I learned the trinumeral system, which I think I've mentioned before. It's the notes I'm pulling from are from June 13th, 2018. Mm-hmm. I have my notebook here. So if it's different now that it's been 7 years, don't at me. Well, no, at me, but be nice about it because I want to know.
mm-hmm.
At this point, the trinumeral system was the museum standard. Mm-hmm. The way it works is there's three numbers, separated by periods. So year of donation. Period. Donation number, period. Object number with a potential compound object subsection letter. Oh,
okay.
So object numbers are given. So the year of the donation is 2018.
Right.
2024.
Sure.
2025. Period. The object numbers are given place values depending on how many objects there are in the donation. So, for example, if there was less than 10 items donated, it could just be 2025 period one. Mm-hmm. Okay. If there were in the donation, meaning like, and the donation is like someone came with a box of stuff and handed it to you.
Yeah.
Because that is one transaction from a donor to the museum.
Sure.
It's processed as such.
Yeah, yeah.
If it was like between 10 and 100, then it would be like, 01, 02, 03. If there was a 100 or more, it would be 001, 002, 003. Okay. That's also very helpful for adding numbers to files, whatever, but that's a little beside the point. Yes. So donation numbers almost always, so donation number is what number donation it was given in the year.
Oh, okay.
And so that's chronological. So say that you were the first person to donate something, 2025, 001, you're the first person, and then the first object of that could be .1, .01, or .001.
Okay.
Okay. Object names, as a side note, are fixed lexicon, so they are cataloged as a donation number, mm-hmm. but then they are given a name for what it is. That is a fixed lexicon. There is a big, thick book that you look in, and you see what it is cataloged as.
Oh.
So you could go into like apparel and then go into hat and then you see what subsection of hat it is closest to and then that is what you call it.
Okay.
Right. However, you know, so once you do that, compound objects. There are objects that are multiple pieces. There are objects that are single pieces.
Right.
So for example, Mark, if you gave me, like donated your wedding ring.
Sure.
That is only one unit.
That's interesting. example.
That is one unit.
Proceed.
If you donated your ring, it would be 2025-015-001.
Sure.
If you donated your keys, mm-hmm. that is a lot of things that could be separated from each other.
Right.
Right.
And they are important in context with each other.
Right.
Another good example would be like a water bottle. So you have the water bottle flask, mm-hmm. you have maybe a straw that's detachable, and then you have the top part that twists off.
Mm-hmm.
Those are three things.
Okay.
What you do is you add letters to the end of the object number for each of those pieces. So a water bottle with three pieces would be 2025-001. That's the donation number. 1A, 1B, and 1C.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then you would label on the object itself each piece individually.
And would 25.01.1 without a letter, would that refer to the whole composite object?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So that would be the one object, and it would be noted that it has multiple pieces.
Yeah.
Right.
Letters duplicate and triplicate with added pieces. So AA, AB, AC, AD, right. And then it goes AZ to BA, BB, BC.
Oh, sure.
I have worked on archives that had so many individual pieces to the same object that I actually used three letters at a time.
Whoa.
So, for example, like 2025-004-015-KIZ was feasible.
Yeah, yeah.
That I actually did reach that.
Sheesh.
There's a factor here, which is like it's initially human readable, but it's ultimately a proper cataloging system that doesn't have to be human readable if the complexity increases.
The important thing is that it is traceable.
Yes.
Yeah.
And comparable.
Right.
And
for simple things, you could do that without aid or assistance,
mm-hmm.
but that does not sacrifice its ability to be as complicated as any collection needs to be.
And the other thing that's important about it is that it implies its importance only in specific context with other things.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, this is important, but it is more important when looked at as a unit with other separate things that are not it itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right? So you can see kind of how it goes like temporally narrower and narrower, and then object-wise narrower and narrower. Like, it goes like time and then donation and then object and then part of object.
Yeah.
So that very much informs how I consider my file structures. I go big and then I go small.
Oh yeah, okay.
And there is one difference here though, that normally in file naming, numbers are usually only used for versioning.
Yes.
Whereas this is used for cataloging. The lessons learned are very transferable.
Mm-hmm.
But would you actually recommend a file naming convention for something that does have many hundreds of assets? Would you recommend using an actual cataloging numerical system for that and less of a semantic system?
No.
I
think the thing to borrow from it is one, time. Chronology is important and can be very important. So, for example, if you're working on it for multiple years and you have, it might be helpful to use the date or to use the year.
Sure.
Especially if that is important to the context of like what is actually relevant, that might be really important.
Yeah.
Dating things are always good.
Mm-hmm.
Two, I think that having some form, using letters and numbers as a way to imply and show that it is a piece of a whole and or could be used in a specific sequence.
Sure.
That's, I think, and I think depending on if you want to use A's and or zeros. The other thing is also place value, or what I mean by place value is like, do you write 001 versus 002 or 01?
Yeah, yeah,
sure.
Because of how file systems organize things, that's actually something that might be kind of important.
Yeah.
There have been many times that I have forgotten this and I will label things 1, 2, 3, and then I will have 10 and 11, and 10 and 11 will be at the top of the file structure.
Yep.
That's annoying as heck, and that makes the things harder to double check.
And, you know, you have to anticipate, you know, how many places you're going to need. And that was actually something I thought of when you were bringing it up initially, that you could use a number of leading zeros or not.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really helpful when you already know how big a collection or sub-collection is. But if you don't, there's some guesswork involved.
There is. The thing is once you get to the point where you realize you need another place value, usually at that point you can then guess like, am I going to go up to 99 or I'm going to go up to 999?
Sure.
And then at that point it's a little easier to just go back and change add a zero to nine things.
Yeah. I suppose so. Then you're the leading zeros, if you've decided those are not definitionally relevant, then that you can change the
meaning. I think that that's something that what it should be is check in with yourself as far as like what you are needing before you find out that you have to rename all of those files. We also will catalog things in the software Past Perfect before we label the objects.
Sure.
I would recommend doing that because then otherwise you have to change the label on the object and it takes a while and is a very delicate process depending on what you're labeling. It might be worthwhile if you have reference to it in a document, in documentation, or you are just like starting to organize the file structure or label your assets to then put into Unity. Mm-hmm. Take a moment and go, oh, wait a second. Okay. Is this going to be confusing later?
Yeah.
That's the point, because changing that your name, changing those assets then and changing your naming convention then is going to be a lot easier than if you're going to have to start changing them when you're in Unity or your other game engine. And then that can also cause problems.
Yeah. I imagine this kind of a naming scheme would be particularly useful if you're doing like spine animation kind of things where you have many different sprites for one body. And then you could label them as such so that like they are potentially even swappable.
Yeah, they mirror each other. Like heads are always A, or heads.
Yeah,
are
or this one. Particular running, and you know, running animations are named such and such. Yes. When I was working on Treasure Stack, that's how we swapped all of the sprites out. Is we just had the name of the character, and the sprites were named in such so that like you knew which animation you were supposed to pull from each.
Yeah, one. I think like you could do that kind of same filtering down of like name of character, action, frame.
Yep.
You know, a little quick tip related to that, if you're working in a game engine like Unity, a lot of times you will reference something by file name in your code.
Yeah.
And it's you've probably heard this advice before. You don't want literal strings, we'll call magic strings, in your code base, because then if something gets renamed, you don't know that it's broken until it breaks.
Yeah.
One of the things that a lot of game engines do is they create sidecar files that contain metadata with like GUIDs, just not computer or machine readable numbers that you don't have to know.
Yeah.
And if you change the file name, that number doesn't change.
Right.
So that helps a lot. Now, in order to make that really useful, is you should be using object references and not duplicated names all over the place.
Yeah.
So that when it comes time for you to be like, you know what, I got to rename everything. It actually is just a matter of renaming everything and not renaming everything and all the references to all those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so rather than in your code saying, look in this folder for this file name, you can say, look for this reference, and then you will serialize the reference that you can just drag in. Now, you may want to change that variable name using normal refactoring, but it won't break anything if you just change the file name. So that's just a little hot tip.
Imagine how nice that'll be when you realize that you actually want to change this NPC's character from Eduardo to Fernando.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then you don't have
plausible
to tell.
Because
then you don't have to tell everybody, okay, like you are going to be like some poor level design intern, I don't know, maybe. And you're gonna be like, okay, you're building out Fernando's quest, but you have to actually use everything labeled Eduardo because he used to be named Eduardo and it's kind of a thing. Yeah.
I've seen code bases like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, what was it used to be called? And that then becomes the machine name.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes you either want to get ahead of that by defining a machine name that you're never going to change.
Mm-hmm.
That is, and then having a semantic name that can change.
Yeah.
Or just being better at it.
Yeah.
And being better when you change it, take an hour and go ahead and refactor everything too. Yeah. You'll save yourself headache later.
Yeah.
And other people headaches.
Do you want to hear a little bit about how I did it with my current project?
Heck yeah.
So I did a bunch of voiceover because we need voiceover to happen. And I have a laptop and I know how to edit audio now. And I like making silly voices while sitting in my closet.
Don't we all?
Yeah. So what I did, I have a file on my computer, chest, subfolder WIP, work in progress, subfolder voiceover, subfolder as recorded, meaning like this is the raw file that of me, Lydia, my voice as you can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go into that folder, and this is where all my little clips that I have exported from Adobe Audition are. The way I labeled those are VO _ the character's name and then a number.
Okay.
I went to this script that I wrote. And I wrote this script in a very specific way because the idea is that you call these patients or these people and they tell you stuff. And then if you call them back, they will tell you the important clues that you need. So you don't have to sit through the whole thing. You just can hear like what's relevant for you to complete the game.
Yeah. Okay.
So essentially like there's a character like named Arnold Stampler. You call him the first time, you get one thing. You call him again, you'll get a different message. So for example, that would, the replay of that could be line 1, line 9, line 5, line 7, and line 8.
Mm-hmm.
Since I broke them up into pieces so that way then they could be recombined into one phone call and another phone call. Mm-hmm. So I labeled the script, instead of it being like Arnold, 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 I named it Arnold 1, Arnold 2, Arnold 3.
Sure.
As I was exporting, chopping up and exporting these files. So that way it would pair up with VO Arnold 1, VO Arnold 2, VO okay. Operator 1. That way when I handed off the audio to Alan, he knew if I'm making the replay audio single file, I need to use these clips in this order. So then what he did, he made my voice into different characters' voices. He put together like the singular audio clips out of the pieces that I made, the component pieces.
Okay.
He then put them into a folder, just 2025. So this is the shared folder for all of us.
Yeah.
Storyline assets / or IRL assets. They're different folders because they have to be different, as we've mentioned before. Audio.
Mm-hmm.
And then then there's all the things. Okay. So then it was listed more like in a similar way, but either related to character first or what part of the game it is.
Sure. Yeah.
So we have, for example, like bartender _ order prompt.
Okay.
We have for Arnold Stamper, phone _AS. Phone _AS _replay.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
That definitely sounds like it's named for programming purposes, but mm-hmm. like useful.
Yeah.
And I think what is recognizable in this system that is carried over from the mm-hmm. cataloging system, which uses numbers, is cascading specificity.
Yeah.
So starting with the broadest category and moving to be more and more specific. Mm-hmm. I think it's really easy when you're naming things to want to name them in a way that is like English language structured.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and that's, you know, if you can get away with it, fine. But I would recommend, and I imagine you would too, is not worrying about if you're using a bunch of English words in a row.
Yeah.
Don't worry about how it reads like a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Think entirely about how it's cataloged as an object and that cascading specificity, I think, is really relevant.
If you've ever read Shakespeare or another play, if you've ever had to cite that in school, mm-hmm. you know, you go act, scene, line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That idea. Because that's how, or you think like chapter something, page something, line this.
Right.
That's where you'll find it quickly. For print assets, kind of similar, but a little different. So we have kind of two sides or like kind of moments related to the content that was written for us.
Mm-hmm.
The content was divided into two halves, initial observations and over time you will learn. And that was how it was specifically referenced a lot in the documentation we were getting from the SMEs. And they were abbreviated, IO and OTYL.
Mm.
So the print assets, the way that Alan organized them is print assets, subfolder, either IO or OTYL, subfolder, the patient name, and then whatever's in there. So for example, OTYL _SP for Sofia Povich, one of our characters, _ serial eosinophile trend. IO _SP _ smoking status.
Okay.
IO _AS _photo. So then, no matter what, we know which folder this has to go into, what patient it's referring to, mm-hmm. and what it is.
Yeah.
Which tells us where to put it in the game.
Yeah.
Right, right, right. Right, because sometimes you'll have things that are structured within your project. Mm-hmm. Other times you'll have things structured within a folder directory. But the most foolproof way you can do it is just to put it all in the file name.
Yeah, and what's really important, both in terms of handing off, but then also double checking, because mm-hmm. we are going to get just a list of these things need to exist and they belong to these patients and they have to happen at this time.
Yeah.
Being able to check one-to-one is really important as well. And that's also something that I think a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
If like I have the list of the file names or whatever, and then I have the checklist of like, what I've had to make and make sure exists in the game, I can check one-to-one if it's accurate.
Yeah.
I will admit a lot of the names that I've had to come up with are very long, I tend to err on the side of extremely long and cascading versus having to shorten them and then have to learn how it gets shortened.
Yeah, I think so, we're like, all on that page.
Yeah.
But so like IO/OTYL was hard for me to learn.
Yeah.
We ended up learning it because it kept being repeated. And it was one of those things. It's like, it's easier for us to learn it than to translate from what we are getting the raw material from.
Right, right.
I will say that I've definitely gotten long-winded with these things. But if it is parsable but annoying to parse, I will accept that.
Right.
That is how I like to name files and how and kind of a little bit of where it comes from. It's something I feel very strongly about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to be able to at a glance know the important information about mm-hmm. the thing. Just by looking at the name. That's why I was complaining about variables yeah. earlier. Mm-hmm. Is because like if you name something clearly, you know what its purpose is,
yeah.
why you're using it, and if you see it in the code later and it's being used weirdly, then you're like, oh, this should either be renamed or I need to use something different or something like that.
Yeah.
Honorable mention, but this is something if you're not talking out of engine, but if uh-huh. you ever have to work with stakeholders, if you ever have to work with documentation,
yeah,
things that I've learned from working with clients is. We would have an external folder that the client could access and an internal folder.
Yeah. Mm.
In brackets.
They don't need to be good at this.
In brackets.
You don't need to teach them how to be good at this.
Yeah.
Okay, but if I ever have a thing, I have an internal copy and yeah. I have the copy I've delivered.
Yeah.
Brackets. External, all cap. End bracket. The name of the document, parenthesis, delivered, colon, the date it was delivered.
Oh.
For internal documentation. Because then I can look and I immediately know, oh, this is the internal version. I can't share my screen yet.
Yeah. That's
or fine. where are the comments for this? Where are the comments my team left? Oh, I'm in the external version. That's why I don't have the comments. Right. The other thing also for my internal documentation that I do for this script, for this project, mm-hmm. parenthesis, last update, colon, the date.
Okay.
I will sometimes put that in the title. I will also tend to put that at the top of the document.
So this is where my strongest opinion on this sort of thing comes in, is that mm-hmm. File names that are outside of systems which impose versioning,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. V1, V2, I can't handle that. Mm-hmm. They have to be, you know, 8-character dates.
Yeah, just use the date.
For everything.
Yeah.
Whether it's the most current version, or if 4 days pass in between and there's a bunch of missing dates, that does not imply there were versions that are missing. Mm-hmm. I don't care if it's version 6 or 7. I only care about the most recent.
Right. Yeah.
And as long as I trust that I'm not losing files, I don't need to see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Well, and it's also because if you save a copy of every file, it's self-dating, it's self-ordering into version 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 because it is ordered by date.
Right.
You know what's first because it was the one that was made first.
Well, that depends on if you're moving around from file systems, sharing it. Like, that metadata doesn't always travel.
Well, I mean, like, if you have it in the title and you save it as a separate
document. In the title. Yeah, exactly. So we're saying the same thing.
Or if it's at the header and you save. If you have the same document saved every time you made a new version of it,
yeah,
the date that is in the document somewhere will order in that way.
Yeah,
right. If you're just alphabetizing, then yeah, it makes things a little bit simpler as well as, like, easier to handle.
But mm-hmm. in general, yes, almost all the time. No one's going to say, hey, can I have version 2 of this? Because they don't know how many versions you have made.
Yeah.
They're going to ask, can I have the most recent version of this? Or they're going to ask, hey, wait a second. When was the last time that you input that JSON file from the translations? Can you check when it was saved as a JSON?
Yeah. And you know, the nice thing about using the dates is that you can reference that with other things. Like if you have a mm-hmm. ticket tracking system.
Yes.
You can see I did this on such and such date. And so if you go back later and you revamp it and you did a bunch of things and you want to be like, you know, actually this version maybe was better. I think we have a little bit of time. You can go back to that and improve it. You can go back to that and you can see what date you completed the task on and see what file you that corresponds to that and then just go back there versus going V1, V2, V3, V4.
Yeah.
You'll have no idea.
It helps also for emails. It also means that if you have an engineer that is making a merge and they're using information that is not the type of thing that can be, if you're using information that is not something that is actually going to be saved as a asset in this, in asset line of like, you did a thing with this asset.
Yeah.
Then like you can say, oh, there was a translation mistake. When did that merge happen?
Yeah.
See the date and then you'll be able to tell, oh, they used the, we had published the new version the day after. They're using old information. That's why it's not accurate. In
right. The yeah. It's useful for archival purposes too.
Especially though, because there are those necessary interplays of people working and doing very specific, accurate, time sensitive work outside of Engine.
Yeah.
And it having to be updated and mirrored somehow in Engine. There's a delay of multiple people and there's time in there. Having the chance to be able to track that and the ways to be able to get that easier is so vital.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to make everything better. It's also going to prevent a lot of bad feelings where it's like, why did you do this? You didn't do it in time. Well, no, I did what I thought was right. You know, it's going to save you so much of a headache.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, we're hammering at home, I think, but like, you know, the date is important.
Yes.
So that it should be important in the thing. I think that from what I'm gleaning from a lot of what you're saying, Lydia, is that like, you want to make sure that your name has important information in it so that you can use that information for whatever purpose that file is for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at that time too.
Mm-hmm.
And so like you put the date in there because you want to make sure in the future that you know when you did this.
Yeah.
You put like specific labels in there so you know what, why, where you're putting it or why it's what you're using it in code or for or what have you.
Yeah.
I think that like all of that stuff is really important for emphasis purposes. So at a glance, you could just tell that this is what it's for.
And so long as you, I mean, obviously certain files, in instances, you can rename things easier than others. If you don't have a system right away, you find it as you go, as quite often happens per project.
Mm-hmm.
You can rename as you go.
Yeah.
You should rename as you go. It's fine if you don't have a system right away. In fact, it's probably better you don't have a complex system right away because you're more likely to hold on to it when it emerges in usefulness itself. You will figure out what is more important to you immediately. For example, it might not be date. It might be time if you're doing a 24-hour game jam.
Yeah, yeah, true.
Hour one, hour two, hour three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I do is date, and then I hang a letter on the end.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the first one is the date, the second one is A, the third one is B.
Mm-hmm.
It's zero indexed, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's very similar to, you know, 1A, 1B, 1C, 1D.
Yeah, exactly.
Et cetera.
Yeah. Great talk.
Thank you.
Great rant.
Thank you.
Lydia, I liked how you posted about International Podcast Day in our Discord.
Yeah, that was really neat.
Yeah, I would love to hear more about fun days that people are excited to experience in our Discord. You can go to nicegames.club/discord and let us know what fun days are coming up. I'm sure there's another International Pancake Day coming. Somebody let me know. So I could go and get my pancakes.
Otherwise, you're going to have to wait for like Easter season.
Yeah, I'm like, who wants to do that?
Yeah.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you can also talk about the program on the Discord.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, yes, cool. Yes, yes.
Just checking.
In fact, you should. You should ask questions of your peers, of us, of everybody. Talk about something cool you listen to. There's a lot of really good ways that people share, like, oh, this made me think of this thing that I've been doing. And that's been really fun to hear.
I think everyone should follow Lydia's advice on naming conventions, no deviations. But that doesn't mean that your specific naming conventions are going to be exactly the same as Lydia's. So let's hear yours.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear how you name things and why. Because I think there's a lot to learn from like seeing how other people do stuff.
Absolutely.
And that happens on the Discord.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So go to nicegames.club/discord. Let us know. Okay, Lydia's done ranting.
Uh-huh.
Mark, your rant.
Yep. Okay, it's not a rant. Listen, I've ranted on this program before.
Oh, you have.
Okay, so quick background on this topic. For people who are Unity developers, you will have likely gotten an email some weeks ago. It's been a little while now, and we're not super timely on these episodes.
Mm.
So this is, I would describe, on the verge of old news.
Yeah.
But it's still relevant if you've been putting it off or you haven't got a full handle of it. But a security researcher discovered a vulnerability in the Unity Player, which is the runtime that goes along with your game.
Right, right.
Unity games.
Okay.
And this allows potentially for an attacker to replace third-party library code in your project with arbitrary code.
Oh.
And this is done through command line arguments. So if you've ever, you know, used the command line to run a program, you give it some arguments before you launch it to launch it in a certain condition. You can do that with anything in most operating systems. And with Unity games, this is done for debugging purposes.
Yeah.
Even in release builds. Mm-hmm. And one of those things is you can actually like replace where certain things live. And now that's not going to happen for every game and yada, yada. All the details are interesting. And we'll put some links in the show notes for you to find more of those. But the upshot of it is that every single game that shipped with the Unity player since 2017 has this vulnerability, which is theoretically exploitable.
Yeah.
But would normally require local access or the developer to have created a custom URI scheme. It's very hard to exploit. I will start this off by saying the actual risks to users is exceedingly low.
Okay.
But theoretically very high. So it is kind of a weird, it's hard to describe it because the way Unity has tried to describe it to people is one, it's kind of a PR issue.
Yeah. Oh,
it's like, you know, people are always looking for reasons to hate Unity.
Yes.
And this could easily be one of them. Mm-hmm. And so their communication has to be very clean and simple. And they've done, I would describe, as good as Unity ever does with this sort of thing.
Okay.
Which is like, you know, fine.
What a way to describe it.
But basically, yeah. It's like, this is really urgent. Don't worry about it.
Sure.
That's the shortest way I could describe it. It's very urgent. Don't worry about it. And that sounds insane and contradictory, but it is absolutely true.
Yeah.
So how can something be urgent, but also don't worry about it? Because usually urgent means I should start worrying about this right now.
It's sort of like if you, this is maybe not the right thing, but imagine you have a structure in a parking lot.
Okay.
And there's not a tree for miles.
Yeah.
And the thing is made out of steel.
Mm-hmm.
You should probably still put a fire smoke detector in there.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Oh. Yeah.
Because like it's like there's no world in which you could justify not putting a smoke detector in that structure.
Because something can and would happen, and it would be way better if you have a smoke detector there than if you didn't and something bad happened.
Now the statistical likelihood
is so low,
even in an environment of neglect, is of actual danger is so crazy low.
Right.
That you could essentially not worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But at the same time, you can't really make an argument for not doing anything about it.
Yeah.
That's maybe. I mean, it's a little tortured, but that's maybe the best metaphor for this.
Got it. Okay.
Is that the and so Unity's response to it was basically in that vein, like trying to really reassure people. And one of the things about this thing, it was discovered during what's called a bug bounty, mm-hmm. where security researchers who are basically white hat hackers, right?
Okay.
They try to exploit systems, and then when they find an exploit, they report it to the company, and they're given $50,000 or something.
Dang.
Like, they're pretty big prizes.
Okay.
People make their careers doing this.
Yeah.
And it's really a quite valuable service.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing field. Really fascinating, creative individuals are part of it because it requires so much different kinds of thinking to find all the different ways you can do things.
It feels very much like the kind of creative thinking and chutzpah that you need to be a good QA tester. But for vulnerabilities and software.
Yeah, and you have some researchers who specialize in certain types of attacks
because mm-hmm.
that's where their knowledge lies. And so that's why you need a lot of different types of people doing this and why you host these events for independent researchers. Because mm-hmm. you can hire your own internal teams and people and big companies do this.
Yeah.
But that actually just institutionally is harder to deliver these kinds of really interesting out-of-the-box results.
Mm-hmm.
What you kind of want is someone who doesn't know how your systems work.
Oh.
Yeah.
Who approaches it from the outside and is not influenced by anything
yep.
that an internal researcher might be considering.
Yeah.
It's kind of like how I was talking last week you never know when the player is going to be mashing the A button.
Yep.
Like, it's because you're too close to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know? So you don't know what can go wrong.
Yeah.
So that's basically the background on this. Is it was a standard bug bounty procedure. It was put on by Meta. They have an Android-based platform for their VR systems, and Unity is very popular for VR. It's probably sort of the de facto VR engine for a lot of users. And so that was kind of this. It was reported to Unity in the spring, and then Unity worked on plugging it up, doing what they needed to do, and then it was announced on October 2nd.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a couple weeks ago now.
Yeah.
And I described what the exploit does, but what it means is sort of in an unprecedented way, every game made since then should be updated.
Right. Okay.
Which is actually very unusual. But in games, we don't deal with a lot of security patches.
Yeah.
It's not really a thing we think about that.
Right.
Much. So back to the beginning, you might have gotten this email that says, hey, you're a Unity user. If you've shipped something, please update this. And so you may be wondering, Do I have to? How do I do it? And Unity has all these resources for how to do it. They were actually really well prepared. The tools they deliver are great.
Okay.
They updated every version of the engine, so you don't have to update to an incompatible version.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is kind of a scary thought. You may have thought this when if you got this notice. Like, well, I shipped a game a couple years ago in an engine that's no longer supported. And, like, do I need to update? Then it's, like, a whole thing.
Right.
My game didn't sell that well, so what do I care?
Yeah.
Like, not any developers would be in that situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to walk through as much of this as I can, as quickly as I can.
Okay.
And we're going to put a lot of resources in the show notes.
Yeah.
If this is not information you've gotten already. I'll first say that the platforms this affects is our desktop platform, so Mac and Windows, Android, but not iOS and not consoles, mm-hmm. Not WebGL, and not UWP, if anyone uses the UWP platform on Windows.
Oh, okay.
Nobody does.
Okay.
But Android, Mac, and Windows, and Linux as well. We'll get to Linux in a bit. But those desktop platforms and Android are the ones that can be exploited.
Okay.
So, for the vast majority of games, all the things about it make it sort of not something you have to, like I said, not worry about. It's a sort of practical non-issue.
Yeah.
And Unity has said, like, they really are sort of talking out of both sides of their mouth on this in a way that is just seems so, in a world where everyone distrusts Unity, is like, well, what am I supposed to take seriously? And having analyzed this and knowing enough about how this stuff works, I can tell you, if you trust me, that, like, Unity is saying the thing you're supposed to say. They're right in both ways.
Okay.
It is very urgent. If you have a commercial game that's shipping, I think you, because it is a security issue and not just a feature update or a bug or something, I think I would recommend not delaying on this. But at the same time, no exploit has been discovered in the wild. There's no examples of it being used, particularly in the more the dangerous type, which is to go to a website and click a link that opens up your game and runs the code, which is that's the potential worst version of this exploit. Mm-hmm. No version of that has been seen. And they didn't even actually test for it. It's essentially, theoretically, it could be done, but no one has done it.
Yeah,
so no essential worry again. There's a big part of this that I'm going to get to at the end, which is maybe the most important part, which is that you as a Unity developer communicating to your players what this is and how, because it, you know, gamers are a wily bunch and you have to kind of be delicate sometimes with what you say. And when you leave an information vacuum, other people will fill it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is kind of important that and you kind of ultimately have to say what Unity said, which is, this is a big deal, don't worry about it.
Yeah. I mean, also, if you are making games for a client and the client has varying levels of security needs,
yes,
that is also extremely important.
That's a really good point. For a lot of us, it's just like, you know, it's video games, who cares? Mm. But for a lot of people working in Unity, they have they deal with clients who have very specific requirements about this sort of thing.
Or institutions. So, like, if you make games for for the healthcare system, for the army, for a company.
And indeed, some of those are actually governed by both internal rules but also regulations, because the vulnerability is part. This vulnerability is part of the CVE, which is the Common Vulnerabilities and Exposure Standard, which is a huge database that the entire security software security industry contributes to, which standardizes and catalogs all of these, and they have a great naming scheme, Lydia. catalogs all of these things and gives them severity levels. So part of Unity's reaction is because this is what happens when it reaches this severity level. Mm-hmm. These are the steps you take.
Okay.
So again, in games, everything is sort of case by case.
Yeah.
But one of the nice things about this is that there's been a standardization that, like, if this is how it's been classified, this is what you do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so definitely if you have clients who adhere to those standards, they are going to demand compliance with those standards.
Mm-hmm.
So for that and many other reasons, get on it. And the way you get on it is you've got three options, basically.
Okay.
Well, okay, first you have four options. If your game is in development,
don't worry about it. Don't, it's not
seriously,
out.
Seriously, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But you should definitely upgrade your version of Unity as soon as possible. Now, this is a great excuse to update to a new, like, minor version. If you're, like, on 6.0, you know, it was a great opportunity to move to 6.2. Mm. You were going to have to do it eventually anyway.
Yeah, probably.
Might as well do it now. you can also just update to the next point version,
mm-hmm.
and you're good.
Yeah.
Every current version of Unity is good. And importantly, if you were, say, locked the version you're on, let's say your game is long in development, and you just, for some reason, are locked to 2022.2.
Sure.
Or .3, probably, because the LTS version. But
okay.
Whatever. You can still upgrade that version.
Mm-hmm.
Every single minor version has a point update or a patch release that will address specifically this security issue and nothing else.
Okay.
So you're very safe to upgrade it, whichever version you're on, to the very next one.
Right.
And not, you don't have to worry too much about your workflow.
Yeah.
If you are in development, especially if you're relatively early or mid-cycle development, I would say get on the train, get to the head of the train
might
now.
As well.
Because you're going to have to do it eventually. It's one fewer time to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good excuse. But it's pretty easy. Again, important to that idea that like the smallest update you can make just patches this and nothing else, which is going to be, I'm going to recommend that exact same approach for you for updating your game, and I'll get to that in a bit.
Okay.
For released games, you have three options. First one is to do nothing.
Okay.
So I've talked all about this on how I recommend, there's many, many reasons. No one will recommend this option.
Mm.
It is a legitimate option.
Sure.
You know, it's on you to decide how importantly you want to take this.
Yeah.
I think it is very reasonable to say that the risk is like catastrophically low in terms of like if you have to update something that is going to lead to a lot of labor for you. And I would I'll describe this. It's not a difficult thing to do.
Okay.
But if in your situation you are like, oh, I feel so guilty, but I would have to put in 4 hours of unpaid time to make this work, even as little as that, then it is within your moral rights to say, I'm going to do nothing.
Okay.
Now that depends certainly on the size of your install base, how new your game is, certainly how you think players might react once players get a hold of this information. We might be a different situation now, but from where we're sitting, gamers have taken very little notice of this.
Yeah.
And a lot of games have been updated, but many more will be updated as the weeks progress.
Right.
And it might be something that gamers start to notice and want to learn more about what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a game that hasn't been updated and you might have players asking you, you be ready to tell them why you're not going to update it. Again, it's an option. Again, Unity has been sort of trying to say it both ways here because they have an FAQ and they say one of the questions that they, hypothetical questions is, do I need to take my game or application off of any platforms to ensure users are protected? And Unity's answer is a little very diplomatic. They say there's no need to pull games off any platforms. There's no evidence of any exploitation of the wild. And I'm paraphrasing a little. There's, Unity has proactively provided fixes to developers, and many of our platform partners have put additional protections in place.
Okay.
So this is their kind of, this is the closest they're going to ever come to say you don't have to fix it.
Yeah.
They're not going to say that. They shouldn't say that. But it is, they are not recommending that even if you don't fix it, that your game needs to be removed from any platforms.
Sure.
Yeah. They're saying essentially, like, it is still a conscious decision you are making not to update your games. And that is one that you are responsible for.
Right. To the point at the end that they make that there are other protections in place, this speaks to just how low the risk is here. Because Microsoft Defender, which comes with every copy of Windows, other antivirus software, which you shouldn't download, Microsoft Defender is good and you should leave, don't pay for anything more. Mm-hmm. But all of those things will block these exploits already.
Oh, okay.
So when they announced this, Microsoft had already updated it.
Ah.
Steam then updated their, Valve updated the Steam client to prevent those specific command line arguments from executing.
Okay.
So very deliberate a block of this specific exploits. Because if you've ever played a Steam game where a little modal pops up and says launch it in this version, or this version, all that really does is give command line arguments to the application.
Sure, okay.
So Steam has an interface for this already that is exploitable in this way because that's how games are launched through Steam.
Yeah.
And so Steam just says, well, as long as we're in control of that user flow, we're just going to prevent us from invoking any of the potentially harmful command line arguments.
That makes sense.
So, again, as Unity says here, there is so many protections in place outside of your game being patched. Now, that is to say, not every user is going to have access to those protections.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Most will. But, the games you release on itch aren't necessarily.
Yeah.
Users on Windows 7 probably aren't.
Right.
There's plenty of folks still holding out on that. Mm-hmm. Probably Windows 10 is fine, but Windows 10 is also exiting support lifecycle pretty soon. So, again, you do have the option to do nothing. But it's going to be more of like a social cost.
Okay.
Is Steam going to eventually check to see if you've done this or not?
Yeah.
We don't know. It's an incredibly high number of games that this is impacting.
Right, yeah.
So it is not in the financial interest of any platform to start taking games down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for that reason alone, which is maybe not the right reason, but for that reason alone, I don't think there's going to be a lot of action. Now, who's to say what'll happen in a couple of months?
Mm-hmm.
So many games get updated and, Google, for example, they're a little bit of a tighter grip on the Google Play ecosystem. They might at one point issue a guidance that said, okay, we've given you enough time now. If you don't do it in the next couple of weeks, you're off the platform. So so again, you do have the option to do nothing, but those are the potential consequences. We just don't know.
Okay.
Currently unknown. Okay, so your other two options involve actually patching the thing.
Okay.
First is to just create a new build, right?
Oh, sure.
This is Unity's first recommendation. This is the thing that you should definitely do if you can.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this isn't always practical, and I'll get into it in a bit why. This is great for recent and currently supported projects. If you're already going to do a patch update pretty soon anyway, like...
Then it's fine.
Then, yeah, you don't need to do any... They have some special tools to address this specifically, but just update your version of Unity. And in this case, I would say do just the next version, right?
Yeah.
Even if there is a minor update, even if you've got stuff in the wings, you know, just update and then make a new version. Version number for you. Post it, and I'll get into more of the details on exactly how to communicate that. If you have an older or out of support projects or things where like you don't have the development environment set up, you don't have that copy of Unity that it shipped with, you don't have a particular third-party tools that you used to build it, maybe licenses you used for that are expired or you don't have access to it anymore,
mm-hmm.
This is a much less attractive option. You may not be able to do it at all.
Yeah.
So there's a patching tool for this, and we'll get into that.
Ah.
Also, Unity versions before 2019.1 have not been updated. So I was saying every version of Unity has been updated, but not every affected version.
Okay.
From 2019.1 all the way to Unity 6.2 dot something, or Unity 6.3 beta.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
All of those got little updates. But if you're using a version from 2017.1 to 2018.4,
okay,
that, you know, year and a half of things, those, if you have a game that shipped with those versions, you cannot update that version of the engine to make a new build. You can still patch those games.
Okay.
You will have to patch. Or you can go in and update to 2019 or further to make a new build.
Sure.
Depending on the scale of your project, you may or may not want to do that.
Yeah.
But it becomes a less attractive option to create a new build. Plus, you know, what if you want to just do this now? Like, the faster way is to patch an existing build.
Okay.
This is the best option for a very quick resolution, particularly for older projects. This is what I did for Widget Satchel. For Blippo Plus, which came out weeks ago.
Yeah.
Wild timing. I did create a new build.
Okay.
And I'll get into, again, the details on these two options in a bit. But patching an existing build is the best option for a quick resolution. And Unity made a patcher utility. They shipped this immediately with the announcement. And it's very easy. It's very good. They did a great job with this.
Okay.
There's a version for Windows and Mac.
Okay.
And whatever platform you're on, you can patch Windows, Mac, and Android builds.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. If you, like many indie developers who are on Windows and you made a Mac build and it was some complicated procedure to do, you can actually patch your Mac build with this tool. Now, the code signing requirements that Apple imposes is a whole other universe of trouble,
mm-hmm.
and that's outside the scope of this.
Yeah.
You're still going to have that trouble. You'll have to re-sign it using those same procedures. On Android, though, you can actually re-sign it within the tool, which is kind of nice. A little bit easier because, you know, they play nice with others. Some considerations here for Android, especially if you're on Google Play, which is most people on Android. Google is allowing an exemption to the submission rules. So normally, people who work in consoles know this pretty well. There's a rolling version middleware table where you sort of have to keep updating your Unity before you release. Otherwise, you'll no longer be able to release a version with an older engine.
Yep.
And that's, you know, within like maybe a year and a half, you've got a lot of time to upgrade. You don't have to be totally on the bleeding edge.
Yeah.
You can lock, you know, a year before shipping, usually. Maybe it depends. Sometimes it flows. But Google is, that window is much tighter with Google.
Sure.
It's really annoying. They require you to update SDKs while you're in development much more frequently.
Yeah.
To keep on things so you can keep testing with their system and so you can finally release.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they have made an exception in this case.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly how you enable that. You might have to submit a support ticket. I haven't, I don't have a Unity game on Android, so
okay,
I don't know this part of the process. So look into that. But you, again, so you can just update the existing engine that has a particular Android SDK compatibility, even if that version is no longer accepted for new additions, because they'll ask you to make those updates when you make new versions of your app.
Okay.
They have an exception this time because of the severity of the security issue.
Yeah.
So look into that if that's you. Linux consideration. The patching tool is not available for Linux, and it does not patch Linux games.
Ah.
So this means that Linux games made with versions 2017.1 through 2018.4 cannot be updated in any way.
Oh.
Because, unless you do a new version of the engine.
Yeah.
Because there's no new version of the engine, of those versions of the engine, and you can't patch those games. So that's kind of an interesting bummer. But Unity has said that the vulnerability presents a much lower risk on Linux. This is a case where you can kind of see their point of view of like, okay, the audience is smaller, and actually the way that applications work, it's still a danger. You know, it's not, you know, that Linux is any more secure.
Yeah,
it's just that the way the exploit gets structured, it just happens so that the damage you could do is a little bit less.
Okay.
On a Linux machine, even though it's just as vulnerable.
Yeah.
And so they just decided not release the patching tool. It might also be because, you know, they did have a couple of months to work on this, but like, it's still a pretty tight timeline for like such a robust solution.
Mm-hmm.
Updating every single version, making sure there are no breaking changes, doing this patching tool. I could also see that be something that they just didn't have the resources to do right away.
Okay.
They may do an update. They have been updating the patching tool with little UX fixes mostly.
Oh,
no substantive changes, but they may in the future include a way to patch Linux games. Okay. Currently, they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this, I didn't update the Linux version of Weighted Satchel.
Okay.
Because the only way I could have done that would be to get a new version of the engine of that and do a new build.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do that.
Sure.
And I think I had the information enough to say that, okay, you know what? It's fine. The Linux version is on Steam and on Itch. The statistics on that are very low. The Windows version works fine on Steam Deck. I'm okay even if one of those platforms decides for some reason that they need to get rid of or ask you to remove versions. So,
yeah, okay.
So I didn't update the Linux version of Widget Satchel. Had it been a more recent release, I would have.
Sure.
Because it would have just been easier for me to do.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you're creating a new build, I think you should only update the editor version and make no other changes. So if you're currently working on a bug fix, if you're doing a content update,
mm-hmm.
and you're almost ready to release a new version, I would say save that. Make a new version. This is just my recommendation. That there's at this point forward, the guidance from platform holders and from Unity, we've reached the end of that. Now this is my advice. If you make an update for a new build, it should only include this patch mitigation so that your release notes can say that, and so you can track that in your own version history.
Right.
It is very tempting, I think, to hide this in an update it's on its way.
Mm.
Partly because like we don't really want to talk about it. Like I'd rather not tell my players I'm making a Unity game because like they don't need to be part of that conversation, and it's very toxic people's attitudes about that sort of thing.
True.
And you know, of course it can delay the release of the fix.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the urgency I think is you know, like I say, the risk is very low. But you kind of just want to get this done quick. And if you're going to make a new build, I recommend just going straight from the existing code base or the release code base. Now, if you're in your project and you've been making changes,
mm-hmm.
You're going to have to roll back to where you were. And now this is where I'm going to ask, say, like, I really hope you tagged your Git commit with version numbers and build ready commits so you can do this. Like, right? You did that, right?
Right.
Now, yeah, right.
If you didn't do that, you've got a whole other thing to deal with.
Yeah.
But I recommend, where possible, make it so the only update to this version is going to be just the editor version that you change. Roll back, make a new build, then reapply your changes, either they're stashed or they're in a fork or something. And, you know, if this all creates a big headache for you and you can't manage that, that's fine.
It's also the patcher.
No. Actually, I would say before going to the patcher, I would say go ahead and just make a new build.
Oh, yeah. Because
the patcher... There's a whole thing with version numbers. You know, this is the episode on naming convention.
Yeah.
There is a little bit
specific about
there's a hiccup here that actually is very annoying, which I'll get to. But anyway, if that's a headache for you and you can't manage that and you have to deliver other updates along with it, well, then so goes it. And maybe there's a bit of a delay for you. And also let that be a lesson to you. if you're patching an existing build, the patching tool is very straightforward. There's some things to keep in mind. You should be, you know, keeping track, archiving all your builds, mm-hmm. especially your release builds, at the bare minimum, your release builds. Make a copy of that. Don't just patch the copy you have, like, because you want to keep the old copy, not because you want it to, like, run anywhere, but just for your own records.
Yeah.
And because when you're patching a build, you're not incrementing the version number that's stored in the binary.
Right.
So actually support tickets for various versions. Now, if the only change, and the in the patching tool, it's going to be the only change. Mm-hmm. It's going to be just patching the Unity player.dll file.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you don't really care, but I would, you know, the digital pack rat that I am, like, you should, for your own records, make sure that you know the difference between those two builds, because you don't want to mix them up. And they're going to be functionally, they're going to look no different to you from the inside or the outside.
Yeah.
So make a copy, give it a new name, give it a new version number.
Yeah.
But at the same time, your version number isn't changing. So add another number. So this is where you get, you cascade your specificity.
Sure, yeah.
So if you're using semantic versioning and you're like, 1.1.1, this version is going to have to be, I'm sorry to say, 1.1.1.1.
Oof, but all right.
Semantic versioning says, no more than two dots and three things, but like whatever, this is just for your records.
Yeah.
If you call it 1.1.2, that's great for your records, but then when that game loads up, if you have any code in there, any metadata that references the version number, it's still going to say 1.1.1.
Yeah.
And so just for your own sanity, find a way to notate it differently in a way that is going to be compatible with the information that's in the binary, but also make sense in the system that you define for yourself. And you might name your build numbers by using a dating system. You might do it with the semantic versioning. You might do it by some other crazy way. Make sure it works with that and is compatible with the system. It's annoying. So for Widget Satchel, the version I shipped was 1.0.3.1, which is bleh. Mm-hmm. But that's because on the title screen, it actually shows the version number. Because a lot of games do that for support reasons,
mm-hmm.
and you want to continue doing that. But players are going to be confused. Like, which version do I have? And you're going to have a hard time telling them, but at least you can tell them it's that, but added an extra thing. So the patching tool is very simple. It's really just put in your build, or in depending on the platform you do, Android, Mac, or Windows, put in the DLL file or the mm-hmm. shared library, because that's all it's replacing.
Yeah.
It's not replacing your EXE. It's not replacing any of your game code. It's just replacing the Unity player library.
Okay.
So Android has some extra considerations for build numbers, because Google Play requires you increment them.
Yeah.
And that's just an integer that goes up and up and up. There's no semantic versioning there. Your version number is going to remain the same, at least in the binary. You might change it in the Google Play platform or the developer portal. But the Mac and Windows one, you just throw in the library, hit the button, and it makes the change.
Okay.
So hopefully you've already made you're doing it on a copy and not the original archive build that you've saved, because mm-hmm. then you'll mix things up. That's all you needed for that. Considerations past the point when you're patching games is, again, the option is ideal for older games, and be sure to track the life cycle of the patch version. So it's going to fall outside your normal versioning system, like I was describing earlier. So just like make sure that this one's a weird one, do it in a way that won't confuse yourself. There's no one correct way to do it. If for some reason you must continue to use unpatched versions of Unity Editor, I can't imagine really why, but if you are going to make a feature update later, but you're not going to update the Unity Editor, you will have to maintain the patching tool as part of your build process.
Yeah.
The scenarios where that's going to happen are crazy limited, but that might be you. Because there are a tiny, tiny number of breaking changes that apply to this, but only if you're using the kinds of things that these exploits would use. So again, very small number, perhaps no games at all. Okay, last thing I'm gonna end on is the sort of versioning, publishing, communicating, like how you tell users about this.
Uh-huh.
So like I was saying, I recommend really just an update that only contains this, partly for your own sanity, partly because the patching tool and the new build, it become a similar kind of thing. Other games are going to be making these updates, so I think it's going to be clear to users what it is. When you say, it's just that game got updated with that thing, then they don't have to look at the rest of the release notes, they know. Or if they don't know, you can explain it to them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But also, this is a security update. And I think this is something we as game developers don't really understand, or we don't really deal with that much. But
yeah.
Like in the world of traditional software publishing, there are differences between, feature updates, content updates, and security updates.
Yeah.
And different people who use that software have different policies on when the user is going to update.
Yeah.
And in the world of corporate IT, or in web page and server development. So like we use Drupal as a backend for the Nice Games Club website.
Sure.
There are updates to all those plugins and all the time. But we don't really ever update it unless there's a security update.
Yeah.
And so that is something that in games we're not really used to that idea. But as long as we're playing in that space, let's follow those rules.
Sure.
So I would say, because it's not going to have a feature or content update, it's just going to be a security update, you are telling your users that this is an important thing to update, but it's not going to change the game at all.
Yeah.
Because you'll have users who are either suspicious or they're speed running your game and they don't want to make an update because they think it might break your thing or
something.
Or, or you're making a change that they don't want to use and they want to use an old version of the game, which is their right.
Mm-hmm.
As a security update, you're telling them, I'm making no other changes.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important contract to have with your users. It's just not something we as game developers are familiar with.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to just respect that as long as we have to play in that space for a brief moment.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully never again.
Yeah.
But we'll see, right?
Yeah.
So depending on the project, if it's old or new, you may or may not want to like publish release notes. I would recommend doing a little update, at least if, on Steam. They have a process for this. Itch does as well. Any other platform has ways to sort of talk about what the update is. I just recommend being just sort of plain and upfront. Again, the communication's kind of difficult. This is a big deal. Don't worry about it. As a developer, you're in a slightly better position than Unity on this in that you don't have any liability concerns like they do. So you can be a little bit more plain about what's happening here. You can say very specifically, this is not something you need to worry about. Windows is already mitigating against this. You have nothing to worry about. But because it's classified as a CVE high severity thing, we're releasing the security update and we recommend you download it. Everybody download it.
Yeah, okay.
Pretty simple message. That's what I did for both Blippo and for Widget Satchel. And so far, no gamer has gotten upset about it. But, you know, you never know. Because it's a real fear. I know we joke about it sometimes, but like, you know, you don't want to give gamers a wrong impression and you don't want to leave a vacuum of information where you just do this update and don't say anything about it or you hide the update in another thing. Mm-hmm. Players are going to learn about this thing and then wonder why your game isn't updated because you didn't put it in the release notes.
Yeah.
And then you try to tell them you did and they're going to be like, oh, them developers are trying to trick us. Like, this is the most bad faith interpretation of how a gamer might respond.
Uh-huh.
Like, those gamers are out there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think because like trying to quietly sweep things under the rug is unfortunately a thing that we experience as people who consume things a lot.
True.
Like gamer or otherwise.
Yeah.
That aspect of like, and then they quietly fixed it and didn't let you know because they were hoping nobody would find out is a thing that you hear a lot.
Yeah. And it's going to be very tempting if you're just, like, you know, especially if you like your game has a small amount of users or it has a large amount of users that have a lot of opinions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're going to be really worried about like, how do I say this exactly right? And the thing is just be confident, plain, straightforward. And if you deliver this as just a security update with no other changes, make it as small a deal as it really is.
Mm-hmm.
And just people will just, they'll take the minute to download it and update it as soon as they have the time to. And you'll have done your job and everybody will be happy. And if we all do that, then we as a developer community can set the tone for what this is for our player base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we actually all sort of owe it to each other to sort of move together on this and not try to ourselves contribute to the sort of misinformation and paranoia about Unity as an engine or about, you know, game updates or about how developers treat players.
Right.
Like,
just be plain about it. It's weird for us. I've never had to deliver a security update in my life.
Uh-huh.
And I delivered two this week. So, but you know, it is actually really quite simple.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. So I delivered this presentation because you may have noticed I was just talking the whole time. I delivered this as a presentation for our local game dev community event. I made slides for this. We'll put the slides in the show notes.
Yes.
So you can review this information and we'll put the important links. Unity, if you just Google this thing, Unity has all this information, but they haven't given this event a canonical name. So it's actually kind of confusing to like find this stuff.
And that's frustrating.
Unity documentation has its own sort of like fiefdoms and qualities. And
yeah.
It's not like it's that complicated, but it's like the kind of thing you expect from Unity, which is just not as clear as it should be.
Uh-huh.
So we'll do some of that clarity for you if you're curious about this, and we'll put those links in the show notes, as well as my notes for you to find my recommendations on top of what you'll get from the official sources.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And hopefully everyone will be sort of happy and contented and no trouble at all.
Yeah, thanks for letting us know about that, Mark.
Yeah.
Consistent theme today is the idea of if you don't schedule maintenance schedules itself.
True that.
Great,
true that.
Great button. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode or others or whatever with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.